Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Hey, everybody. This is Chris Malanfi, host of Hit Parade, Slate's podcast of pop chart history. Welcome to The Bridge. That's Ike and Tina Turner's Proud Mary, the best-known cover of Creedence Clearwater Revival's classic song. We just played you the part where the song bridges from a slow vamp to a killer rave-up, one of the most famous tempo changes in rock history. And that, of course, is Ms. Tina Turner, bridging you from nice and easy to nice and rough. And as always, these mini-episodes bridge our full-length monthly episodes and give us a chance to catch up with our listeners and enjoy some trivia. This month, as always, I'm delighted to be joined by the colleague who helps me take it to the bridge, Slate Podcast Senior Producer TJ Raphael. Hey, TJ.
Hi, Chris.
How's it going?
Good. Thanks so much for having me on.
Always a pleasure.
I'm so glad that you just played that Tina Turner song because I mean, I'm a huge Proud Mary fan in general. You know, it got me thinking about how much Creedence music has been covered by other artists. And then also the concept of when does a cover sort of outpace the original, you know, become so well known that we kind of forget the original, or maybe it overshadows the original. I think the first time that I heard Proud Mary was the Ike and Tina version. I don't think it was actually the Creedence version when I was a kid. So can you talk about, you know, some of your favorite covers or some artists that, you know, their song was covered and now it kind of belongs in some ways to a different artist?
You know, some of my favorite covers are the ones where the cover is truly transformational, and you're right, then it kind of belongs to the other artist. I believe you and I talked about one of these when we did our tribute to Aretha Franklin last summer. I often reach for it as my favorite cover of all time. It's kind of the most famous cover of all time because so many people barely realize it is a cover. Her number one hit, Respect, is a song by Otis Redding. It was recorded first by Otis Redding. And the story has been repeated so many times, it's frankly probably apocryphal, but Otis reportedly said, "That girl stole my song." And he said it admiringly. He knew that the song no longer belonged to him. There are covers I love because they are so transformational. For example, one that was not a hit, but of course the original is a massive hit, is the Rolling Stones' I Can't Get No Satisfaction. My favorite cover of that is the utterly strange cover by the Ohio rock band Devo, who absolutely turned it into their idiom. They digital rocked it up and, you know, kind of made it this herky-jerky synthy thing, but it's such an amazing amazing cover. It completely transforms the song and the tempo and almost everything about it. It's nearly unrecognizable. Yet, you know, there are stories that they had to get Mick Jagger's permission for it, and Mick Jagger loved it. So it was definitely approved by the original writer.
Well, one of my favorite cover songs where I think the cover has kind of, in a way, outshone the original is All Along the Watchtower.
Absolutely.
I love Bob Dylan. He is amazing. But the Jimi Hendrix version is just incredible. The guitar in there is amazing.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion.
Sort of become so synonymous as well with Jimi Hendrix. When you say All Along the Watchtower, you don't just think about Bob Dylan, you really think about both of them in a lot of ways. And that's really one of my favorite covers.
You know, we could do an entire conversation about covers of Dylan and about songs that were utterly transformed, because of course Dylan has his own inimitable, you know, sometimes loopy way of singing his own songs, and then they are turned into big pop hits. Everything from Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds to Blowin' in the Wind by Peter, Paul and Mary, to more recently a ballad that's been covered by everybody from Billy Joel to Garth Brooks to Adele, which is this ballad that doesn't even sound much like a Dylan song, but Dylan first wrote it and recorded it for his late 90s album Time Out of Mind, and it's since kind of become a standard.
I could hold you for a million years to make you feel my love.
So before we move to trivia, I really want to quickly talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Last year, of course, you did an entire episode on one of our inductees, Bon Jovi, which got a lot of people talking.
It did indeed.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction is back. It's coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about who's being honored? And there's one that I think a lot of people are watching and talking about.
Yeah. First, let me run down the list, and let me take a quick victory lap, because in that Bon Jovi episode last year, I closed by saying, hey, if we're going to start doing hair metal of the 80s, why have we not nominated Def Leppard yet? Well, I'm not saying I did this single-handedly, but let's just say Def Leppard are getting inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. So I'm gonna take minor credit for that. In addition, The Cure, Stevie Nicks, Radiohead, Roxy Music, The Zombies, and I'm leaving this name last for a reason, Janet Jackson are being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. And in terms of what people are talking about, you know, Janet Jackson, as a member of the Jackson family, is in the middle of obviously a tremendous convulsive controversy right now, not involving herself, but involving her brother Michael. And we're taping this episode in the immediate wake of the HBO documentary Leaving Neverland, which discusses the allegations against Michael Jackson by James Safechuck and Wade Robson. And it would be an understatement to say that this is the conversation dominating popular music right now. And I suppose it's too soon to say, but one wonders whether Janet, who has not made any specific statements regarding her brother, will be drawn into this controversy given the perhaps unfortunate timing of this moment of glory in her career. As a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voter myself, I voted for Janet Jackson proudly. I am excited for her, and I really hope that this moment when the culture is considering how it deals with the art of Michael Jackson in the wake of these revelations, I hope that that does not overshadow a moment that Janet has richly earned. And I think we will need to wait and see how that plays out in the weeks to come.
So before we move on to trivia, last year, you kind of predicted that Def Leppard would get in. Can we get a prediction for this year? You know, who in 2020 are we going to be saying, oh, God, Chris Melanfi, he got it right again?
gosh, that's a tough call. So Radiohead finally got in. I'd been saying for a couple of years that they were a shoe-in. I was frankly surprised it took two tries to get them in. You know, The Cure just got in after being on the ballot a couple of times, and I often joke about what I call the holy trinity of British mope rock between them, Depeche Mode, and The Smiths. All three of those bands have been on the Rock Hall ballot. I would say the less problematic of the two, given that The Smiths are fronted by Morrissey, who's a bit of a controversial figure, would probably be Depeche Mode. Mode, so perhaps this indicates that Depeche Mode would stand a chance if they were back on the ballot, or maybe other 80s, 90s rock legends from the world of alternative music need to make their first appearance on the ballot. The Pixies have still not been nominated. I would be intrigued to see how they would do if they were on the ballot. So I don't know. We'll find out next fall when they put out the next list of the next short list of nominees. But this ballot definitely checks some boxes that have never been checked before. And it'll be cool to see if they can now move on to some acts that are overdue themselves.
Well, congratulations to all of our 2019 inductees. Here's a little Janet to take us out before some trivia.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Now comes the time in our Hit Parade the Bridge episode where we do some trivia, and I am delighted to be joined this month by Becky. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Chris.
How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you doing this.
Oh, I'm thrilled.
I understand you're a musician yourself. Is that right?
I am. Yeah.
Super cool.
Yeah. I'm sort of like CCR. I do unfashionable 2 to 3 minute guitar-driven rock songs.
Good for you. You know what is slightly, I'm going to digress for 10 seconds. What is slightly fashionable is that there's all these reports hitting the music biz now that because of streaming, songs are getting short again.
Oh yeah. Maybe that's my chance.
This is your opportunity. Seriously, the 2 to 3 minute song is where it's at right now. If you can feed people something catchy that gets its point across in 2 minutes, 15 seconds, they might record it and you might have a hit. So, yeah, go rock and roll. I also understand that you are a Slate Plus member. Is that right, Becky?
I am, yeah. Proud Slate Plus member.
Excellent. So that's important because while this Bridge episode is available to all Hit Parade subscribers, we only open our trivia rounds to Slate Plus members. So if you are a member and would like to be a trivia contestant, visit slate.com/hitparadesignup. That's slate.com/hitparadesignup. So as you may recall from previous episodes of Hit Parade the Bridge, we're going to do 3 trivia questions right now. The first one will call back to last month's full-length episode, and the next 2 will be a preview of our next full-length episode. And then when we're done, you will get to turn the tables on me. Are you ready for the trivia, Becky?
I'm ready.
Fantastic. Question 1. In last month's episode, we heard a lot of Proud Mary. Creedence's original version came out first, but who scored the first cover version on the charts? A. Anthony Armstrong Jones, B. Solomon Burke, C. Elvis Presley, or D. Ike and Tina Turner?
Well, I remember you saying that Solomon Burke had a cover version, and I think you said it charted. I remember Elvis had one as well, and of course, Ike and Tina Turner, but I'm going to go with Solomon Burke.
And you would be correct. That is
right.
B, Solomon Burke. Big wheels keep on turning. Proud Mary keep on burning. You're just rolling, rolling, rolling on the wheel. His version only hit number 45, but it was the first cover to chart. Anthony Armstrong Jones from the world of country took it to number 22 on the country charts just 2 months later. Ike and Tina, of course, had the biggest version, but not until 1971 when it reached number 4. Fantastic. Nice job, Becky.
Thanks.
All right. Let's do 2 questions now that will be a preview of the next episode. Here we go. Question 2. In his legendary career, Stevie Wonder has scored 10 number one hits on the Hot 100, including 4 in the 1980s and 5 in the 1970s. But what was his only number one Hot 100 hit in the 1960s? A. Fingertips. B. My Cherie Amour. C. I Was Made to Love Her. or D, uptight?
Oh, gosh. You know, I remember he started off as Little Stevie Wonder, so I'm guessing one of those was released under that name. I'm going to go with Fingertips.
And you are correct again.
Oh, that,
the correct answer is exciting. A, Fingertips. It went to number one in 1963 when he was known as Little Stevie Wonder. It was his last number one hit for nearly a decade. Excellent. You are running the table here, Becky. Great job.
Hopefully I can keep it up.
Hopefully you can keep it up. All right, here's question three. Let's see how you do. In the 1970s, Stevie Wonder generated the longest streak of Grammy success when he scored three back-to-back-to-back Album of the Year winners. Which of these 70s albums by Wonder did not win that prize? A, Inner Visions. B, Songs in the Key of Life. C, Talking Book. Or D, Fulfillingness First Finale.
A lot of really good albums. I'm going to go with Talking Book.
You have run the table. That is correct.
All right.
Talking Book.
Excellent. Very superstitious.
This 1972 album was, surprisingly, not nominated for Album of the Year, but all three of Stevie's next studio albums were not only nominated, but won the prize back-to-back on the Grammys of 1974, 75, and 77. Well done, my goodness. You crushed it.
Well, thank you.
So congratulations for running the table. And now, of course, comes the point where you get to turn the tables on me and I get to, ruin this beautiful streak that we have going of perfect trivia answers. Are you ready to ask me a question?
I'm ready.
All right. Give it to me.
Okay. Stevie Wonder was only 11 years old when he signed to Motown and was able to score a number one hit with the label at age 13. While Wonder is known for his music, he also has deep political roots. Motown itself also has political roots that may be lesser known to many. Which of the following civil rights activists did Motown record a spoken word album with? A. Elaine Brown. B. Martin Luther King Jr. C. Langston Hughes. Or D. All of the above.
I am pretty sure they recorded an album with Dr. King. And so my temptation is to run right for that one. But on the other hand, I suppose it's possible that they could have recorded the other two. I will go with D, all of the above.
You're right. It's D, all of the above.
That's amazing.
I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality.
The record label founded by Berry Gordy made stars of the likes of Diana Ross, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and countless others. But Motown also had a spoken word label called Black Forum, which was set up by Gordy in 1970. It released compilations of speeches, poetry, and oral history. Among them were works by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Langston Hughes, and former Black Panther Party chairwoman Elaine Brown, among others. 2 years after he was assassinated, the label released a speech by Dr. King called Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam on the Black Forum label. Stevie Wonder also has ties to the late civil rights hero. He was a huge force behind the movement to create a national holiday recognizing the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On his 1980 album, Hotter Than July, Stevie Wonder included the song Happy Birthday, his ode to Martin Luther King Jr., and his call to make MLK Day official.
I love that song, and I often share it on friends' birthdays. I believe our former Slate colleague, Aisha Harris, did a wonderful article about how it is basically unofficially become the Black Happy Birthday song, you know, a song that was originally political but is now taken on resonance as, just a celebratory song at birthday celebrations. So Wow, that was a fantastic question. I actually learned a thing or two while amazingly getting it right and not blowing our perfect streak today. So I think this stands as the only Hit Parade the Bridge where all of the questions were answered correctly. So good for us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be part of Hit Parade history.
You certainly are, Becky. Thank you so, so much for taking part and for joining us this month. And I do hope you enjoy our Stevie Wonder episode.
I'm sure I will. Thank you.
Oh my God, you broke your streak. Yay.
Thank God. Thank heaven. Finally. Man, it was getting embarrassing for a few months there.
It was a long time, but I mean, this is a good question to come back to. So, you know, it's a strong one. It's a powerful one.
I like the history in it, and I like the reminder that Motown really took its mantle as sort of, in Berry Gordy's words, the sound of young America and the sound of Black America quite seriously. The facts in that question were really on point.
So can you tell us a little bit about the next episode now that we know that it's going to be about Stevie Wonder? Is there going to be some Motown connection in there? Can you give us a little bit of preview before we head into next month?
Right. Well, Stevie Wonder really is a singular artist in every way, including in the Motown stable. And I want to talk about kind of the front half of Stevie's career. Where do you begin with Stevie Wonder, right? It's an epic career. It's still ongoing. Thank heaven, you know, he's still with us, not recording as frequently, but, you know, still touring. And what I want to talk about is the unusual way Stevie Wonder's career began and how many of us, notwithstanding the fact that Becky, our guest, just got that second trivia question correct, you don't hear Fingertips, his first number one hit on the radio, very much anymore. And I want to remind people what an interesting singular career Stevie had in the 1960s. He began as a child star, and then he also made a move toward independence that is almost unprecedented. It's singular within the history of Motown. It's unusual in the history of child-to-man careers, and then the just epic success he had in the 1970s, not just commercially, but critically, sort of redefining the sound of pop, funk, R&B, rock. You know, it really is amazing. Honestly, we could do 4 or 5 episodes about the career of Stevie Wonder, which is why I want to kind of hone it in on about a decade to, call it a dozen years of his career, and that's what we'll be talking about in this next episode.
Well, I can't wait to listen, so I'm really looking forward to it, and thank you so much again for having me on The Bridge, Chris.
Thank you for being here, TJ. I appreciate it.
I'm TJ Raphael, the senior producer of the Slate Podcast Network.
And I'm Chris Melanfi. Keep on marching on the one.